And we are live. Roland Lazenby, thank you so much for joining us here today. Truly, truly excited for this interview.
So am I, Nick. Thank you.
Absolutely. So I'm going to do my best here to give you a bit of an introduction. And then if you don't mind filling in any of the blanks I may have left out.
Yeah, happy to do it. It's no big deal. I'm not awesome. A big introduction guy, so...
All right. Well, let me fire off some stats here because I think they're pretty impressive. So you've written more than 5 dozen nonfiction books. You've published more than 50 books. You were once quoted as saying, "Me in school, that was trouble," which I thought was interesting for someone who's been as successful as you have been. You covered the Bulls for much of the Jordan era, the Last Dance era. I think we're all familiar with the Last Dance Netflix TV show. I actually have a question about that later on that I'm excited to talk to you about. Before you were with Chicago, you were with Boston, the Lakers and the Pistons, I believe. Right. And then you're great friends with Tex Winter, who, if anybody's a fan of the triangle offense, then I think you know who Tex is. So... does that interview do you justice?
Yeah, that's good. That's great. That's good
fantastic.
Work.
Fantastic. Like I said, Roland, truly excited for this interview. There's a bunch of different topics that I really want to get into with you. I guess before we get into any of the specifics, just a general overview. You went to Virginia Military Institute. Talk to me a little bit about your childhood growing up and then getting to Virginia Military Institute. What was that experience like and what did it teach you about life?
Well, those are good questions. I grew up in a little town in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia called Wytheville. And, just sort of... good old boys having fun, you know. I don't know. I was not a skilled student by any means. But I read a lot as a child. I had no thought at all about ever being a writer. It was not like, oh, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a sports writer. And I went to college. If you had told me that, I played a year of football in college. Then I played 3 years of rugby. If you had told me I was going to be a sports writer, I would have laughed out loud. I did dabble a little bit in writing, but not much. And I graduated in the bottom fourth of my high school class, and I graduated last at Virginia Military Institute. I never had a 2.0. I got a 1.996. They rounded it off to 2.0. which allowed me to graduate. So I set no standards academically. I served 3.5 years of barracks confinement for conduct issues. Just was not a very good cadet. But I did a couple of things. I won a couple of writing awards. I don't know what possessed me to enter some of the writing contests. And I was a biology major for 2.5 years, and that was a disaster. I was not skilled enough as a student to do all the memory work. I was frivolous. But I switched to English, and I went out for a play. This was in fall of 72. It's called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was based on the book by the author Ken Kesey, and it became a famous movie later after that, starring Jack Nicholson. And I got the lead role in the play, and I'd never been in a play in my life. And so that was a profound thing. But, just somebody in search of things. I did, by age 24, though, I was a varsity head coach. And that was a great experience for me. During the period, I was diagnosed with an aneurysm. I had this brutal headache. I was rushed to the hospital. They determined I was about to have my first bleed. And they told me I had a 30% mortality rate on my first bleed. I had a wife and kid. And they kept me 10 days and I never had the bleed. And they gave me a bunch of tests and none of them were conclusive. And so they discharged me. They said, we can't give any more tests. We have one, but if we give that to you, it could cause a stroke and we don't want to do that. So my wife came and got me. I was in great shape then, 24 years old in it. So I went, I said, I got to know. So I went and ran 5 miles and everything was okay. And so in the next 6 months, I decided I want to be a writer. And it wasn't, I want to be a sports writer. But the only job I could eventually get was being a sports editor at a weekly newspaper. So I left my teaching and coaching job and went to work for minimum wage at this weekly newspaper writing sports, writing about the high school where I'd just been a varsity head coach. I later went to a daily and I won awards in writing. They weren't big awards. But then I went and became a feature writer in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. And then I came to the Roanoke Times, which is further in the western part of Virginia, larger daily. And I was a night police reporter. I covered crime and then I covered courts and I covered prisons. And my old man had been a basketball nut for a long time. And he got sick while my first year as a newspaper reporter. He had brain cancer. And he died. And I'd always enjoyed playing pickup basketball. But after he died, I just started playing it religiously. And I also had entered grad school. I was going to grad school, getting a master's in writing while working about 60 hours a week as a newspaper reporter. It was a busy time. And one of my writing professors said, you know, if you want to be a writer, you need to write a book. So I made a list of good book topics right there in class. And Ralph Sampson was at the University of Virginia getting ready to complete a stellar career there. So I wrote a cultural book on Ralph. And that did well. It was independently published. It was publishers, you know, you couldn't get anything, but it sold a bunch of copies. And it was excerpted by the Associated Press. It was excerpted by the Sporting News, which was a national sports weekly back then. And it prompted John Thompson to agree to hire me when Georgetown won the 1984 NCAA championship. He hired me to write their championship book. Also, I got to know Billy Packer, the broadcaster, who had been a player at Wake Forest. And Billy, of course, was at that time already the top broadcaster in college basketball. Billy and I ended up doing 5 books together. But I was just sort of doing, for about 5 years, I stayed in the newspaper business, working on books on the side. And then I jumped off. The Georgetown contract helped me do that. I made more money in about 12 weeks doing that book than I made in a year working as a reporter. So I was off and running, and I didn't even realize it, but I'm a pretty intense guy, pretty driven, and all of that translated well. I was working and doing lots of things, and so it's just a contracting business in a lot of ways. Being a writer, you're going from one contract to another. It's idea driven. And I was always developing ideas for books. And that has propelled my career along for a variety of reasons.
So you start writing books and obviously, you're a huge fan of basketball. One thing leads to the next, and now you find yourself writing these biographies on some of basketball's best players, some of the you know, most talented players to ever touch a ball.
Yeah, I did. There was an important interim step there. I started doing a lot of coaching. I had kids. I had been a public school coach. I became an AAU coach. And when I started covering the Bulls, I got to be very close with Tex Winter. And I started running the triangle offense because most writers didn't understand it. Most fans didn't understand it. And Tex Winter was, I could call him anytime and we'd talk basketball. And I coached a fair number of youth teams and a couple of AAU teams. And it really took me deeper into the understanding of the game and those things. Anyway, I'm sorry. That was an important step.
No, absolutely. And we'll get back to Tex because I have a couple questions there as well. I actually just finished Phil Jackson's book, 11 Rings. Yeah. And obviously he drew, you know, a lot of influence from Tex as well. They were obviously close, being on the same coaching staff. But really quickly, I want to ask you this question. So somebody once asked you if you were ever going to write a biography on LeBron. And you are quoted as saying, at the time, I'm under contract to write a book about him, but I'm not going to do it. It's too hard writing these books. It takes up too much of my life. I've just finished spending almost 3 years on my Magic Johnson book. In many ways, I've been a ghost in my own life due to my work. 5 years. Yeah. Writing one single biography. So take us behind the scenes of what it actually takes to write these biographies, the amount of research that you do, and the amount of effort and dedication it takes to actually compile an entire history on one person.
It's pretty tense. And, you know, I've spent time with the people I write about usually. I was around the Bulls and really worked to where I got one-on-ones with Michael a good bit. Kobe was a young player. I spent a lot of time talking to him. He cycled in and out of media figures, but for a significant time there, I was a guy he talked to a lot. I could call him in his hotel room, and he would talk about things. He was a miserable kid in the NBA. It was all older men then. There were not a lot of... It's not like today where a lot of the players are very young and a year out of high school or whatever. With Magic, I was able to get key interviews. I was around for key things. I didn't have as much time with him as I had with the other two, but I had a good amount of time. A lot of people write biographies or writing about dead people. They don't even know him at all. But I've always liked to do interviews. I've done mountains of interviews. I like doing historical research. And I like to tell the full stories of athletes, it's not just basketball. It's history and basketball. It's these are big cultural stories, too. These are big cultural figures. That's why my Jordan book's in 21 languages. He's a hero all over the globe because of his competitive nature. Kobe's in 12, ditto. People, you know, there's statues in China of Kobe. Magic, ditto. Hugely competitive people. And I like writing about great competitors. I am doing a LeBron book. Basically, it's a movie first. I was on a Zoom today. I'm a co-producer, one of three producers on a film about an early portion in LeBron's life. And that's fun. I've got two other projects I'm doing. I'm 71. I thought I was going to retire, but while I was wrapping up the Magic book, I had just three excellent book projects present themselves to me. So I've been working on, while I'm doing this launch of the Magic book and all this other stuff, I've been working away. Now, we had black mold in our house, so my life's been in a blender. We had to get out of the house in like 6 hours, and we were out of it for like 8 weeks. And I couldn't get to all my materials. I'd been working pretty intensely on these projects, and I still kept working on them, but then I ruptured my quad in the middle of all this. So I had to have surgery, and quad injury is a major, major thing. And it's especially major for an older American such as myself. But I'm making progress. I had done a lot of rowing before this happened. And so I think, you know, I maybe can get in back to walking pretty briskly again after a year. Got a lot of rehab to do.
What keeps pulling you back? You know, you mentioned you're 71. You're still writing these books. It sounds like you're doing a lot even outside of the world of biographies. What keeps pulling you back, Roland? Why not just hang it up? You know, call it a good career. I'm sure maybe your wife would enjoy that. What keeps bringing you back to studying some of the game's best?
I was watching some footage of Merle Haggard, the country star, on Instagram the other day. And Dan Rather was asking him, "Why don't you retire, Merle?" Merle says, "Well, I'm afraid of being alone." He said, "You know, if you want to be alone, people will leave you alone." But he said, I like to keep playing, and I like to keep my proficiency up, and I enjoy it, so I'm going to keep doing it. I got a brother who's 81. He goes into work every day. And I don't know. That's a good enough role model for me. I enjoy it. I enjoy the people I'm working with now. I enjoy the challenge of it. And, you know, it's a good thing. I've got a friend who did 30 years in prison on a pot charge, and he is out now. He is 76. You know, you're in prison. They maybe give you a few pennies for Social Security, but he has to shovel concrete 6 days a week to keep it going. And he's my hero. He's a pretty amazing guy. And so there's a lot of people out there still working. It was the human condition for a long time. And I don't know where it'll wrap up, but I'm not too worried about it.
Well, listen, as someone who's a fan of your work, I certainly appreciate you continuing to work and put out the amazing content that you
do. That's very nice of you to say.
It comes from the heart, Roland. Trust
Thank
me.
You,
and,
Nick.
And for those listening or watching who haven't checked out Roland's work, in the description, we'll put all of his books that you can go check out. Highly, highly recommend. Roland, I want to get to a little more of your journey. So coming into the NBA, covering the NBA, you started off with the Celtics, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was really, this was in the late 80s. And, you know, the old garden was there, smell like piss. but it was really something to go to the garden and sit there. I'd get there 2 hours early or more. I have my media credentials, and I'd go down there and sit and watch Bird go through his pregame shoot around with trainer Joe Cotato. One of the highlights of my life, to watch him work, to get ready to go out and perform well. And it would only go on about 25 minutes. He always told me, you don't want to leave your game on the floor before the game. But just enough to get, you know, and I played pickup basketball. So, you know, I'm just some bozo out there having fun. So, but I have a credential that allows me to talk to people. And so it's good.
What was it like covering the NBA during the Bird, Magic, during the height of their rivalry, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it must have been just amazing to watch those two go at it.
Yeah. It was amazing to watch anybody go at it in the old NBA. You know, the game that was then is no more. And, you know, it was a very powerful man who changed it. He got permission to change it, and he changed it. And I don't think it'll ever go back, but it's not what it was. And the people of my generation and others who are fans younger really can't watch today's game much. I can watch a good bit of it because today's game's gotten a little better. But it's weird that if you invented a time machine and say you wanted to put the 2015 or pick one of those really great Warriors teams, and those are great teams. You pick one of those teams and then you say, all right, let's put it up against one of Jordan's teams. And so you could pick one. I would say probably 95, 96, but I don't know. It could have been any one of them. And so Kerr coached one of those teams and played on the other. But you really wouldn't know how to stage that game between those two teams because the game has changed so much. It has different rules. The man who was allowed to change it changed the crap out of the rules. I have my guesses as to why he did it, but the point is that you would have to pick if those two teams were going to play. They're like from different planets, and you'd have to decide which era's rules you would use. And if you ran, let's say that you picked the rules of 2015, well, the Bulls couldn't run the triangle because the rules were specifically changed, it appears to me, to force everybody to play one way super fast and to prevent people from playing. And I mean, my opinion is you ought to be able to run whatever damn system you want if you're the coach. But now you can't run the triangle in the modern game. And they like to act like the game evolved. That didn't have anything to do with it. But I think Phil Jackson was such a nasty dude in snide little ways. And he rubbed it in so much, and this was Tex Winter's opinion, that he created a lot of dislike. And, you know, he did it with the Bulls. That was okay. But when he moved to the Lakers and started winning, that's when Jerry Colangelo, who owned the Suns, got permission from David Stern, the commissioner in the NBA, to change the rules. And it was a couple of things. You know, Colangelo knows basketball. He later headed up Basketball USA. But they trimmed the timeline down to from 10 seconds to 8. You got to really push to get it across the timeline. Triangle is a two-guard front. It's not a one-guard front. It's a two-guard front, and the guards sort of make their way up the floor, and they're sort of staggered, but they get in place. And one guard makes a pass to another, and then the one guard cuts through to the corner, usually a really good three-point shooter like Steve Kerr. And with the triangle, you know, you have all this different stuff, but basically Michael Jordan always played on the weak side, usually opposite Steve Kerr filling the corner. And when Steve Kerr filled the corner, you had to send an extra defender over there with him because he'd knocked the bottom out of it. And so that meant that it was really hard to double-team Jordan or later Kobe. Although Phil Jackson wouldn't let Kobe do the things and have the freedom in the triangle that Michael Jordan did. But it also depended, because it's an offense that moves the ball, it also depended on offensive rebound. Thus, guys like Rodman were gold. They were money because they produced extra possessions. And the old rules, you had 24 seconds to, once you got an offensive rebound, to set it up and execute again. Well, the man who wanted to change the rules, Mr. Colangelo, because he had a team developing in Phoenix that became known as 7 seconds or less.
Those teams were, by the way, sorry to cut you off, those teams were insanely frustrating to play against. I've been a Sacramento Kings fan my entire life, and I still to this day have memories of that 7 second offense and Steve Nash just running the ball up the court, Rajah Bell in one corner. You got Amari Stoudemire filling the lane. I mean, those, you know, it frustrating, very frustrating.
it was. They didn't play much defense, but, you know, and by today's standards, they don't play with all that much pace. They were okay. They're nothing like the teams pushing the ball today. And these rules have been in place in the game. First, let me say that we had a game in 1979. The regular season ratings fell 25% for TV games in the NBA. The league was in trouble. Here comes Larry and Magic. And they bring this very different style of play themselves, you know. It's team basketball. It's exciting. And David Stern is in the process of taking over the NBA. He was the outside lawyer. And then he became sort of the business manager. And then he sort of worked a coup to become commissioner. And he cared. This is a guy who cared a lot about the NBA. And so, and Larry and Magic are a perfect gift for him. He begins planning big global things for the NBA. Nobody gave a shit about the NBA before that, by the way. I mean, there was a small cadre of fans, but nothing like today. They had trouble most places selling tickets. And by 1979, you had a variety of the teams losing money, losing millions. And so that reversed itself. Then here comes MJ. You know, the rules in place presented the best of the best to the world. I mean, it was crazy good. And even with the bad boys doing what they do, even with Pat Riley becoming really in love with the bad boys and first infecting bad boy strategy with the Knicks, and then moving to Miami, it didn't matter. But because basketball, you know, produced these global figures, and here comes Kobe, and you know, you have this succession and Tim Duncan, and you could make the case the rules did not need to be changed. Basketball had become the second most popular and profitable sport on the planet, behind number one, soccer, European soccer, right, to be specific. And so, but it's decided it's all got to be changed. Colangelo says it's boring. He has his designs on it. And so the rules, you can see it in Tex Winter and I sort of worked together an article about the 05, the Miami Heat win. It's called The Death of Defense. And Tex pointed out two things in that. The rules interpretation switched to saying you could not touch. If you're a perimeter player, you could not brush up, impede in any way an offensive player going to the basket. And Dwayne Wade went crazy with that. But meanwhile, You know, the Colangelo thing, they really needed to do something about the post player. They didn't like it. D'Antoni didn't like it. You know, they could be trouble. You know, they play defense. They block shots, you know. And right. D'Antoni was a really nice man, a really good offensive coach, and couldn't do shit from Shinola with defense. And so Colangelo persuaded David Stern that, oh, this is bad. Basketball's going bad. It's bad, bad, bad. It's terrible. You know, we produced all these global heroes. We have all these people playing this game that is followed. But there was an old axiom in the NBA that had dated back to the 1940s when the league was founded after World War II. They were really having trouble selling tickets. And you had Eddie Gottlieb at the Philadelphia Warriors. He let Jumpin' Joe Fulks play lots and lots of minutes, and he became the first guy to average 20 points a game. Later, Eddie Gottlieb would get Wilt Chamberlain, and he let Wilt play all but 4 minutes of an entire season, only 4 minutes off the floor, and he scored at humongous levels. And so there was this idea that fans are going to go nuts if you kill off a lot of the defense and, quote, too much physical play. And play could get physical. It would become hard to referee some of those bad boys games. But the NBA had already begun dealing with that. And you not only had Kobe, you had Tim Duncan and all those guys, San Antonio. The NBA was off and running, and it was a very good sport. And, you know, a funny thing happened. Jerry Colangelo had been a GM. He ended up owning the Suns. And somebody came in and paid him $400 million for him before he ever realized the rest of the revolution. But it had taken root, and the rules were changed. And it really took root in 2015. It had affected the triangle. They still managed to win, but it really took root in 2015 when the Warriors won. Now, the Warriors were a different animal. They could have played in any era, really. They could have gone back and played in the old rules. They had such great shooting. They were a really fine defensive team. You know that as a Kings fan. The Warriors could have done it any time. But the whole NBA, the whole age of analytics, everything settled on that Warriors victory, and the guy who got credit for it was Mike D'Antoni. I was doing interviews with him that summer. Everybody was saying, this is what Mike has done. And it was really what Jerry Colangelo had done. Meanwhile, he had moved on to Team USA, having salted away $400 million. So, but the bottom line was the Phoenix Suns never did win a title. And I'm not sure if they ever will. I don't know. The basketball gods may be taking care of that. But the game, most of these teams aren't the Warriors. And you don't have a lot of really effective post play because basically the analytics folks abandoned it. They abandoned the mid-range, but the Bucks brought some of that back. But you have an awful lot of teams just jacking up ugly-ass three-pointers that never have a prayer when they start. And we are determined that our big guys are going to do that. It's not going back because all the scoring that has come with these new rules has made the NBA lots and lots of money. I'm not sure. I guess people are watching these games all the way through. There are an awful lot of people find it many nights they're hard to watch. like maybe a Charlotte Atlanta game. That's some tough cake there. But I guess at this stage I'm just hoping for a little swing back. You know, the idea that they take that timeline back to 10 seconds. They take the reset clock on offensive rebounds to 24. That doesn't mean you can't run. You can have a running team. It does mean you have to play better defensively. The reason Colangelo wanted to cut the clock down, at first he wanted to rush up to get the shot, get more shots up, but he didn't want to have to spend any time defending because he knew that just wasn't the thing. I would love to see, I think it's a shame that one part of the game is now basically outlawed. I think within the game we had that produced all of these great players, we had a good game. Could you imagine European soccer saying, oh gosh, we have so many games that are 1-0 or even worse, 0-0. And, you know, you got these arenas packed with people going, waving flags and screaming and singing songs, and the score is 0-0. Well, it's interminable. So could you imagine European soccer saying, oh, we're going to let the suits run this. We're going to get rid of the goalie so that we have more scoring. I just think it's blasphemy. I'm sorry to give you the old man's take on it, but I am an old man.
I mean, I think it's a fantastic perspective. And I think even a lot of the younger generation, such as myself, I see it all over Twitter, just listening to sports media. I think a lot of people are getting fed up with some of the things that are going on in today's NBA. And so I wanted to ask you, one of those talking points is this whole idea of rest by these players. We're three games into the season and you have players already resting. It affects the product on the court. It affects the fans that are shelling out hundreds of dollars to go see these stars play. Personal example, the Lakers are coming to town here in Orlando on Saturday. My friends and I want to go, but we're waiting to see if LeBron plays, right? I mean, there's maybe an off chance that he rests or doesn't suit up for the game. And, you know, we don't want to spend $200 to go not see LeBron play. So all of that to say, what's your opinion on this culture of resting that seems to have taken over the NBA? And then follow up to that, what do you see as being the main difference between today's players and the players that you covered in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, the MJs, the Kobes, the Magics?
Well, first I think that pace probably necessitates some rest because they are playing the game at a much faster pace. I think this generation of players, I think it'd be hard to find a player with more integrity than LeBron James. And I'm not some crazy LeBron fan, but I just think he has a tremendous amount of personal integrity. And that, and I think there are a number of others. I think that integrity is even more amazing considering how much money they're all making. I mean, it's a lot, right? a lot of money. And, you know, I don't think that will ever go back. I don't know exactly how the game of American pro basketball, which in a lot of ways is global pro basketball now. Tim Cohn, the great coach in the Philippines who won 22 championships with the Triangle, had to give up because of those timeline rules, and he couldn't run the Triangle. Finally, this year, he went back and said, we're going to run the Triangle anyway with the new rules. with the newer rules. And he won the championship. And his players welcomed the chance to do it. But you got to really be good to execute the triangle on a 14-second reset clock. But, you know, teams can get that schooled. I think Jerry Colangelo got a look at the fact, you know, Phil was done in Chicago, and here he comes to the Western Conference, and he wins not only in 2000, but then in 2001. And that's when, and he won again 2002, and that's when Colangelo went to David Stern and said, oh, you know, this is terrible. We got to change these rules. He didn't say it was. And in his mind, he may say, I never thought a bit about Phil Jackson, but I don't think that's the case. Why would you? They didn't want to allow the triangle to control tempo. Now, the triangle ran control breaks. They would fast break when the opportunity was there, but they would just carve you to death in the half court. And it was not like they were out there shooting underhanded free throws or anything. Jordan and the way he attacked and Kobe and the way he attacked were some of the most exciting basketball going. One of the problems was other teams didn't have the discipline to play with the triangle. So I don't have a perfect answer for it. I think it would be interesting to look at the timeline rules and see if they couldn't sort of ease back to a happy medium. I think there are people who are going to want to run like crazy, but there are an awful lot of teams that are just never going to be able to figure that out. And I think that's the thing about coaching. You have guys come along that are just really good coaches, and the rest of the franchises are just so poorly run that they never really find their way to those coaches. Now, for your Kings, I'm the editor of Lindy. I'm the editor
bring
of
up
Lindy.
My Kings.
No, but I was
speaking
going to
of
say,
poorly run.
Oh, they're much better now. I think Mike Brown is a huge upgrade, and in fact, I picked them. I'm the editor of Lindy's Pro Basketball Annual. There are not many basketball magazines left either. But I picked the Kings, and I'm probably going to be wrong, but maybe not, to go to the Western Conference Finals because they've got that really fine young talent. Mike Brown knows what he's doing. I don't think they have a chance of beating the Nuggets. But I the hope for me for the Kings is that they get to the Western Conference Finals. They got some really nice players. They got a guy on that bench knows what he's doing. I just would like to see that. But who knows?
Well, listen, Roland, I'll be honest with you. After, you know, 16 years of not making the playoffs, and not even just not making the playoffs, like 16 years of just misery. You know, sports misery, consistently being voted as the worst franchise, not only in the NBA, but in sports, right? We were up there with the Cleveland Browns for a while. It was tough. It's always been tough being a Kings fan, dating back all the way to those, you know, great Lakers years with Kobe and Shaq. And
And they got robbed, you know? I admire you being a Kings
fan. Yes, thank you. Yeah, they got robbed. The truth comes out. I remember being, you know, 5, 6 years old, watching those games with my dad and watching Kobe and Shaq, you know, night in and night out. You know, that game 6 in 02 was rough. But hey, we still had a game 7 on our home, you know, on our home court that we could have won, but we didn't.
Yeah, there wasn't a full robbery. It was just sort of a, you know.
Right. So that brings me to my next point, and it's about the late, great Kobe Bryant. You know, at the time that I watched Kobe, like I said, when he would tear up my Kings, he tore up my Kings for 20 years.
Right.
He tore up the entire league for 20 years. He was an amazing player. And I think a lot of people didn't really appreciate his greatness until he was gone, unfortunately. And I think, sadly, that might be true for a lot of the players that we have. LeBron is an example of someone that I'm sure we're going to miss and reminisce and say, you know, that LeBron guy was different. You know, he might not have appreciated it in the moment, but what he's doing in year 21 is different and might not ever be repeated in the history of the sport. And so,
right, I agree.
Kobe was an animal. There's a lot of great authors like yourself that talk about his mindset, his determination. I have an excerpt from from one of your writings that say, so speaking about Kobe, you said, on the court, I admired his tremendous confidence and drive, especially for one so young. I met him at the start of his rookie year. He always seemed older than he was mentally. Off the court, it was his determination. He didn't want to waste a minute in his effort to be the greatest. He was unafraid of declaring that he wanted to be the greatest. I believe you were there when he scored his first basket in the NBA.
Yes,
I think you still have the press notes from that night.
Yes.
From your vantage point, from your experience with Kobe, what was it about him that made him so different? Like, what? Give us a little like behind the scenes of what Kobe was like day in and day out.
You know, Kobe, he told me once, I'm not going to let them break me. They keep wanting to break me. I'm not going to let that happen. I just want to be the man. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I'm going to get there. And I want to be the man in this league. He wanted to dominate. Secret to Magic Johnson. Secret to Michael Jordan. They wanted to dominate. However that was, whatever package it took. And Kobe realized that he was going to have to outwork everybody insanely to get there. Tex Winter always thought it was the fact that his parents came home from Europe needing money. Sonny Vaccaro had worked. I don't know if you've read Showboat, my Kobe book, but Sonny Vaccaro had worked behind the scenes. He wanted to screw Nike. He wanted to screw the NCAA. And he wanted to do it by taking the best player and stealing it away from both of them. And that was Kobe. And Kobe, before he signed the Adidas contract, just days after his senior year of high school, he looked at Sonny Vaccaro and said, "Mr. Vaccaro, is there any way that I can sign this contract and my parents can have this money and I can go to college?" And he ended up, you know, if you think about it, he wasted 96, 97, 97, 98, 3 years, really was profoundly unhappy, but worked and worked. And he had a lot of people who did not like him. They assumed that his family and Kobe had forced his way to the Lakers. He didn't have anything to do with any of them. That was all Sonny Vaccaro, as Sonny admitted to me. They set all that up because they wanted Adidas to be in the Lakers spotlight. Kobe didn't give a shit. But not only did he not give a shit about where he played, he was lucky to get to the Lakers. But what he didn't care about, he didn't care about telling anybody. But he knew all of that. He never bothered to make any excuses. He never said, "Oh, wait, this wasn't me. That was Adidas doing all that shit." He didn't say a word about that because he didn't give a shit about it. It didn't have anything to do with whether he became the greatest or not. And because he was trying to do that, he set a standard because he was willing to work to his own detriment, to insane levels. He did not cheat the game. He did not cheat the fans. I was worried about him. I did two books on him. I think what you read was part of the book I did, Mad Game, the NBA Education of Kobe Bryant. I wrote that in 99. I wrote Showboat in 2016. I'm glad I'm doing a Kobe project now, but I'm glad that I didn't write either of those books after his death. But my point is, Kobe had so much of what he admired in Michael, and so much of, he sobbed like a baby when Magic announced he was HIV. Kobe told me all about that. He was a 13-year-old kid in Europe when the family was shocked. They were more shocked than anybody on the planet. But those guys at that level are really, really willing to, they're fearless. They're really willing to go all out to be the man. It is macho to the max. I guess the way I would describe it, because I thought about writing a book about this, and it relates to Jerry West too. It's the ability, and I think it relates to anything you do in life. What you're looking for in life is the ability to care on a deeper level, to find your way to put yourself into a situation. And this is hard to do. It's hard to do this willfully. It's much better if you're just an organic maniac. But for people to will themselves to care on a deeper level. Oh, I've done everything I can do. I'm not going to get up at 3 a.m. and work out like crazy ass Kobe would do. His process was just, I mean, every game, people are sleeping on the plane. He's there going through the next game. He's been through the game he just played, caring on a deeper level. And it doesn't matter what you do. I mean, and that in itself has its cost. I like to say, yeah, I've written some books, but it's made me a ghost in my own life. You know, you have to be willing. Kobe was willing to pay that price. Now, I don't know if it killed him. I know I've coached enough AAU driving like a maniac to make a tip-off. I don't know if it killed him that day. But there's no question. He cared on that deeper level. All those guys do. You know, LeBron James, I've been tracing his behavior in strip clubs as a rookie, you know. He'd go in there and look around, but he wasn't about to. He was so measured, even as a kid. And it's just, that's why I think people are interested. That's why I like to study them, because they're instructive. And every time I get asked about it, I have to dig around once again and the answer is always a little different, but that one phrase is at the heart of every one of my answers. Learning to care on a deeper level. And I taught college for 21 years. That would be one of the messages to my students, whatever you're doing. And I taught reporting and media work. Whatever you're doing, you learn to care on a deeper level. And there's no guarantee that all that's going to do is make you miserable, because basically all these great, great competitors are perfectionists. Jerry West was a miserable guy. Michael Jordan was no fun to be around. Phil Jackson told me once, That was so great to walk in an arena with Michael Jordan on your team. But between games, he was a, you know, he could just make you miserable. He was, you know, it's just not good stuff. Not a guy you want to really hang out with a lot. Always saying and doing some shit.
One of my favorite stories from you of Kobe is, I think you were with him one night after a game, and he was practicing for, you know, if there was ever a situation where, let's say, the Lakers were down two and he needed to miss a free throw on purpose so that they could get the rebound and either, you know, shoot a three to go ahead or score a basket.
It was after practice one day in the Forum in 99 when they were getting their asses kicked by San Antonio. And Jerry West was over on the – there were only four people in the arena by then. And Jerry West was over on the sideline flirting with this gorgeous TV reporter. And Kobe, I was rebounding for him, and he was practicing missing. And he told me then that he always dreamed he would be coached by Tex Winter. And by that point, I'd been around Kobe for 2 years, 3 years. And I about fell over, and I got Tex to call him. And that got all kinds of bells and whistles going off, because you can't have an assistant coach from one team calling. But I got Tex and Kobe introduced, and Tex wanted to ease Kobe's mind. Also introduced Kobe to George Mumford, the mindfulness expert. I've got another one to do here. One more question. I've got to do another interview.
Absolutely. So let's wrap it up here. I guess a good place to end, Roland, would be what have you pulled from studying the greats like, you know, Kobe, LeBron, Michael, Magic? What can people pull from their lives and their success and their habits and apply it to their own lives? Like what advice would you give someone if they want to achieve the same level of success in podcasting, in basketball, in, you know, their day job, whatever it may be?
And there are an array of things out there. It really goes back to what I just said. You know, those guys in some ways had it organically. You know, Michael Jordan was always out to show his father. I didn't understand my own life. And I mean, his father came to love each other. But when Michael was little, his father belittled him. And Michael was always just like, he loved him, but he was like, take this old man. What do you think of this? And that was sort of, and so parental disapproval can drive some of it and make it organic for people. I think wherever we can, as humans, we are here to learn to care on a deeper level. And Michael could make up things in his mind to jack himself into that state, whether it's saying that somebody said something about him or, you know, just make up stuff to get that way. But a lot of times people like that aren't even aware they're like that. They're not even aware of just how driven they are. And, but the rest of us don't always have that organically. We find external ways like Jordan or, you know, Jordan saying LeBradford Smith said some shit to him, you know, and that fired him up or whatever, you know. We find devices. We take things and turn them into motivation. Things that people say or do to us. Now, the hope is that they become motivation to work harder and do things, not to go insane and do dastardly things, but to really work to achieve the things we want. And to, you know, have those moments of success based on how hard you work and how deeply you do care. And probably the best humans have this ability to care deeply about things that aren't even egocentric to themselves. They might just care about people. They might care about animals. Humans are complicated. They put themselves into a lot of different things. I got to catch this next show. Nick, I really enjoyed it. Great questions. Enjoyed
it. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for your time. Best of luck with all
Same
your future
you.
Endeavors. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a fascinating talk. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Until next time. Thanks, Roland.
See you.